This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Talk about newness. This is new to me. Gretchen is new to me. I feel like that I've entered a whole new world that has been very, very exciting. And one of the things that I thought this morning was that when I was reading this week Gretchen's book, was I was going to add another item to Gretchen's habits manifesto, and that is that you can make New Year's resolutions up until the last day of January. And today's the last day of January. So today, it's better than before today or never. And I hope that when everybody leaves here, they will be better than before. The most depressing thing that I read was that, no, I heard this morning on one of your podcasts, I think it was, Gretchen, that by the middle of April, 80% of the New Year's resolutions that people have made, they have broken.
February.
But, oh, I'm sorry, February. Thank you. That's what I meant. So we've got Gretchen here today to make sure that figure doesn't reach 80% for this audience. So make your resolutions when you leave. Stick to them for the rest of the year. Well, I've just felt it's a whole new world to me of entering into Gretchen's world. The Happiness Project, I was delighted to hear about. You see, a lot of other people have been delighted because she sold well over 1 million books. Her books have been translated into over 30 different languages. It's a very, very impressive record, especially for somebody who is sort of a thinking man's Wayne Dyer. I mean, I could not believe it that somebody who the New York Times calls the queen of self-help was quoting Alfred North Whitehead, William James, Isaiah Berlin. It goes on and on. The authors that Gretchen uses to support her theories. It was very, very impressive. I discovered her podcast. I listened to about 3 of her podcasts this morning, Happiness with Gretchen. So if you have never subscribed to those, subscribe. Also, she has a weekly newsletter, which I have not read, but I'm going to certainly subscribe to that very, very, very quickly. Gretchen grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. She went to Yale. She went to Yale Law School. She was the editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. She went on to a spectacular-looking legal career. She was clerking for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. And then all of a sudden, it seemed to her that law was not providing the happiness to her that she had found in happiness as a writer. So she quit and became the writer that she is today. She says that she wouldn't call herself the queen of self-help, that she thinks of herself as self-helpful, not self-help. And her sister, as I understand, affectionately calls her a happiness bully. I don't. She'll have to explain to us of how that her sister found that term. But anyway, I'm just delighted to welcome Gretchen to the store to talk. And as I said, she'll talk, then she'll answer your questions. And then we get to the best part of the evening, and that is when she signs your books. So thank you for coming. And here's Gretchen.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. And I have to say,
I'm at my happiest when I'm in either a library or a bookstore. So I'm ecstatic to be here. I only wish that I had like 3 hours to go through and look at all the choices. So thank you so much for having me here. So I'm going to talk about how I got the idea to turn to the subject of habits from happiness. And then I'm going to throw out some things that I found surprising when I was doing my research about habits. Because there's a lot about habits that I'm sure you know from your own experience. These are some things that surprised me that maybe will be helpful to you as you're thinking about your own habits. Or what is much more fun, thinking about how to work on someone else's habits. That's the happiness habits bully part. And then we'll have time for questions. And that's always my favorite part, to be thinking about your questions. So I got the idea to turn to habits because I was doing all this research and reading and writing and talking to people about habits and happiness. And I began to notice a pattern, which was a lot of times when people talked about a big happiness challenge that they were facing, they talked about something that at its core was really a problem with a habit. So somebody would say to me, well, my problem is that I'm exhausted all the time. And that's about the habit of getting enough sleep. And so I became increasingly intrigued by the role that habits could play in helping us to lead happier, healthier, more productive lives. And then I had lunch with a casual acquaintance who said something that got me absolutely obsessed with habits. I am a habits bully, and I was quizzing everyone about their habits. And my friend said, well, here's the funny thing about me. I would really like to have the habit of exercise. And when I was in high school, I was on the track team. But I can't go running now. Why? Actually, she went to Whitman High School, right? Right around here. Why can't I go running now? And I thought, well, why not? Because it's the same person, it's the same behavior. Then it was effortless, now she can't do it. What is going on? And I became determined to solve the puzzle of habits. And the deeper I got into it, the more fascinated yet puzzled I became, because there were all these things about habits that nobody else seemed to notice or remark upon, which is like, okay, it's understandable why we don't like to form the habit of something we don't enjoy, but people just as often complain about not being able to form the habit of something they love to do. Why? Why is it that we seem so unmoved by the consequences of our bad habits? Studies suggest that up to 50% of American adults do not take prescription medication for a chronic health condition. Why is it that most successful dieters gain all their weight back and more? Why is it that sometimes habits form overnight and other times a habit that you've had for decades will vanish just as quickly? Like, what's going on? So I really wanted to figure this out. And the most important question I wanted to answer, of course, is, okay, how do we change our habits? How do we change them? And there's no shortage of expert advice, right? We've all heard it. Do it first thing in the morning. Start small. Give yourself a cheat day. Do it for 30 days. But what I noticed, and maybe you've noticed it too, is that these work sometimes for some people, but they don't work all the time for everyone. And what I found is that actually there are 21 strategies that we can use to make or break our habits. Now, sometimes when I say there are 21, people get this kind of like freaked out look in their eyes, like, that's too many, I can't handle it, give me three. But it's actually good that there are 21, because that means there's a whole menu from which to choose. Because some of these strategies work very well for some people, and they don't work at all for other people. Or they're available to us at some times in our lives, but not at other times. And so 21 means that no matter what the habit is that you want to make or break, and we use the same strategies to make or break them, there's a lot to choose from. Because the most important thing, and I think this is the key step that so many habits experts and us as habit doers overlook, is that the most important thing that we can do is say, what is true about me? What kind of person am I? So how do I set up a habit in a way that's going to suit me? Because when I talk to people who have tried and failed, you know, who are really discouraged because they've made the same New Year's resolution year after year after year, it's usually because they've set it up in a way that was just not right for them. So, for example, very obvious place where this comes up is morning people and night people. This is a real thing. It's largely genetically determined. It's also a function of age. But, you know, I'm a morning person, and I used to think everybody could be a morning person if they would just go to sleep on time. No, it's a real thing. Who here's a morning person? Who here's a night person? Okay, you know it, right? It's a real thing. So I had a friend who I have known for years, complete hardcore night person, like can barely get to work on time in the morning and often not. And he looked me in the eye and said, this year my New Year's resolution is to get up early and go for a run before work. And I said, have you met yourself? Because call me crazy prediction maker, but I don't think that's going to work for you because you're a night person. And you can tell me, okay, this is what Ben Franklin did or this is what Steve Jobs did. I can read you a magazine article about why this makes sense. But the fact is, if you're a night person, you're most productive, creative, and efficient much later in the day. He was not setting himself up for success. So it's not about willpower or laziness or anything like that. It's about setting up a habit in a way that's going to allow you to succeed. So a big thing to do is to think about, well, what kind of person am I? So now I'm going to throw out some ideas about strategies so that you can be thinking about them and what might work for you as you're setting up your own habits. And one strategy of the 21 strategies is a strategy that is very successful for some people, and for others it's actually counterproductive. And that is, whether you are an abstainer or a moderator, you must figure out where you stand. This has to do with how do you respond to a strong temptation. And I understood about abstainers and moderators when I was reading my one of my favorite writers is the 18th century essayist Samuel Johnson. And so Johnson walked into a party and someone said, hey, Dr. Johnson, would you take a little wine? And he said, I can't take a little. Abstinence is as easy to me as temperance would be difficult. Translation, I can have none, but I can't have a little bit. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's true about me. I'm like an all or nothing person when it comes to a strong temptation. I can have none, but if I start, I'm going to go all the way. I can have no cookies. I can have seven cookies. I can't have one cookie. I've never had a half a dish of ice cream in my entire life. But it's pretty easy for me to have none. I'm an abstainer. Now, moderators get kind of panicky and rebellious if they're told they can never have something. They do better when they have a little bit or when they have it sometimes. And when I understood about abstainers and moderators, one of the great mysteries of my life became clear to me, which is, what is up with those people who have the bar of fine chocolate squirreled away in their desk drawer, and once a day or so, they have one square of fine chocolate. That's like all they need. And, you know, because for me, the whole day would be now, later, two, three, it's my birthday, it's raining, you know, until that chocolate bar is gone. But for moderators, that's what works. A little bit. So who here is an abstainer based on this description? Okay, and who here is a moderator? Okay, so here we see the roots of many an office conflict and marital fight. Because one person brings home a giant carton of ice cream and the other person says, why did you bring that into the house? You know, I'm going to eat the whole thing tonight. And the other person said, well, you need to learn how to manage yourself better. Okay, then it's not a question of who's right or wrong. It's just a different approach to strong temptation. And it's not limited to food. A place where this also comes up quite frequently is technology. My sister said that Candy Crush was actually affecting her career. And the only thing that saved her is her entire phone died. Like, other than that, she would still be sitting in a corner someplace. Or I know a guy who said that it took him an extra year to write his PhD thesis because of World of Warcraft. Some people cannot do it a little bit. So if you can't do a little, try none. Because it sounds harder, it sounds rigid, it sounds more demanding. But over and over, and I've certainly found this true to be for myself, if you are an abstainer, it is easier to have none. It is too hard to have a little. But for moderators, a little is what is right. Now, sort of on the same vein of abstainer moderator, but much more fun, is the strategy of treats. And this is a strategy that's true for everyone. And the strategy of treats is that we should really load ourselves with healthy treats. Now, the first thing to remember is that a treat is not a reward. A reward you must earn or justify. A treat is something that you get just because you want it. And some people worry that giving yourself treats sounds self-indulgent or selfish. But in fact, I'm sure you've seen in your own life, and research shows this, that when people get a healthy treat, their self-command rises. Like, they did a study where they gave people, either they gave them a little gift or they had them watch a funny video, and their self-mastery rose. And we really want to have a lot of self-mastery. And when you're trying to stick to your good habits, what you need is self-mastery. And so treats, they're like a cell phone getting plugged into the wall. They make us feel energized and cared for. And then when we get in that feeling of, I need it, I want it, I have to have it, I deserve it, then we don't reach for something unhealthy. We give ourselves a healthy treat. When you give more to yourself, you can ask more from yourself. But a lot of adults don't have a lot of ideas for healthy treats. They got a lot of ideas for unhealthy treats often, but not for healthy treats. So we want to all have a menu of healthy treats. So I've heard of podcasts. I have a podcast with my sister, Happier, with Gretchen Rubin. And a lot of people say that they will save like a favorite podcast to use as a treat. A friend of mine, she has to get her whole family out the door in the morning. So she gets dressed, gets them all out the door, and then she goes back to bed fully dressed for 20 minutes. She's like, it's the best part of my day. A guy buys new music every week when iTunes releases new music. I know a guy, he does not even go camping, but he's like entranced with camping stuff. So he will go to a camping store and just walk around because he likes the stuff. And so it's good to have a menu. Adult coloring books, I saw you've got a big display. This is like a new craze. If you love to color, that's a great treat. We want to have a lot of healthy treats so that we can give ourselves that charge. But what are the unhealthy treats? You don't want to do something to make yourself feel better. That's just going to end up making you feel worse. And what are the big three types of unhealthy treats? I think you can guess. Food and drink. Shopping. Screen time. These can be healthy treats for some people, but for many people, they quickly become unhealthy treats. So you have to think about yourself and whether a treat is really going to make you feel good and feel energized over the long term. But treats have an important role to play in keeping that self-mastery high. Now, this aspect of habits is something that really surprised me. In fact, it was so counterintuitive that for a long time, I couldn't even really acknowledge the pattern that I was seeing because it was exactly the contrary of what I would have expected to see. But finally, my attention was called to it because several people told me the same anecdote. I mean, like, verbatim in a way that was really felt uncanny and almost creepy. And most memorably, I went to my college reunion and I was talking to everybody about their habits. And so I was talking to Brad about his habit. And he told me the story that I had already heard verbatim from several people. And he said this: well, I wanted to get into the habit of exercise, so I decided to train for the marathon. And I trained for the marathon, and I love training for the marathon. And I ran the marathon, and it was amazing. And then I took off those rest days that they tell you to take off after you run the marathon, and I haven't run since. I had heard this very same story specifically about the marathon. But not only that, I'd heard the same story like, I decided to give up sugar for Lent. And I thought, this is amazing. Finally, I've quit sugar. But now I eat more sugar than ever. Oh, my friends and I decided to do a 30-day yoga challenge. And it was amazing. We did so much yoga. But now I don't do any yoga. Okay, now this is what was counterintuitive to me. What I would have expected, like based on reading, would be that something like running the marathon or giving up sugar for Lent or doing a 30-day yoga challenge would excite people. It would make them more connected to a habit. This feeling of accomplishment, this feeling of having done something, you know, really achieved something, hitting that goal would be energizing. It would make people, it would help seal that habit in concrete. But that's not what was happening, right? In fact, it seemed like the opposite was happening. It was like hitting these goals was shutting down the habit. But how could that be, right? It doesn't seem to make sense. And yet that is the pattern. And what I realized is that aiming for a goal is a great way to hit a goal. It is not a great way to form a habit, because habits are something that are meant to go on indefinitely. Brad wasn't really trying to run the marathon. He was trying to form the habit of exercising forever. Now, don't think too much about forever, because that can be scary. So let that just be in a misty haze over there. But when with habits, it's having a finish line can be dangerous, because when you hit a finish line, what does that mean? You're finished. And then everything can go back to the way it was before. And then if you start again, you have to start over. And starting over is often harder than starting the first time. And so I think with habits, what's more helpful is to think about a milestone. It is an exciting, gratifying milestone to run the marathon or to give up sugar for Lent or to do a 30-day yoga challenge. It's an important milestone, but it is just one of many milestones that you will pass in a lifetime of healthy exercise. Because when those miles, when those finish lines kick in, it's a stopping point. And I think that this explains I think there's many reasons why diets fail, but I think that this is one important reason. Because typically people set it up like, well, I weigh 160 pounds and my goal is to weigh 140 pounds. So, oh, I hit my goal weight. I lost my goal, 20 pounds, and now I can go back to eating normally. And what happens when you eat normally? You go right back up to 160 and maybe you blow right past it. It's not about hitting a goal. It's about eating healthfully forever. And then the last thing I want to talk about, and then we'll have the questions, is I have to say, if everything in the book, and if everything really I've written in my whole entire life, this is the thing that was the most difficult, it was most intellectually challenging to grapple with. And I think for many people who have read the book, this is like the thing that they find the most helpful, which is this personality framework that I came up with. Now, they say there are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide the world into two kinds of people, and those kind of people who don't. And you might have already told, like, I am the kind of people who does. And so this divides the world into four types. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe this framework. And then, and it's whether you're an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or rebel. And then I'm going to go through and ask you to raise your, ask everybody to raise their hand. And so we can see who's in the room, what tendencies are here. Because that's always very interesting. And then I'll make a few comments generally about the tendencies, things for you to be thinking about in your own life or as you're working with other people. But before I start, a few words of warning. First of all, I'm warning you. It sounds really boring when I start, but I promise you it gets juicy, so stay with me. Also, I kind of get the feeling sometimes when I'm talking about the tendencies that some people are trying to figure out, like, what's the best tendency and then, like, shove themselves into that category. And all of these, I promise you, have strengths and weaknesses. All of them can contain people who are hugely successful and also big losers. So be honest. So this has to do with how you meet an expectation, how you respond to the idea of an expectation, an outer expectation, like a work deadline, or an inner expectation, like a New Year's resolution. First, upholders. Upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations alike. They meet a work deadline, they meet a New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what's expected of them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. Next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. They hate anything arbitrary or inefficient or irrational. Their first question is, why am I listening to you anyway? So in a way, they make everything an inner expectation. They have to endorse it. So they would very typically say, like, why would I make a New Year's resolution? Because January 1st is an arbitrary date. That's something that questioners often say. Next, obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. And this explains the mystery of my friend on the track team, which she had a track and a coach and a team waiting for her. She had no trouble showing up. But it was only her own desire to meet her inner resolution. She struggled. And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. If you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. They don't even like to tell themselves what to do. Okay, so now we're going to go through and raise your hand when you hear your tendency. First, upholders. Upholders readily keep outer and inner expectations like, my hand is up because I'm an upholder. That's my category. Okay, next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. Okay, next, obligers. Obligers readily meet outer, struggle to meet inner. Finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. Okay, so, and then who did not find themselves in this framework? So that's pretty good. Okay, and if you're saying to yourself, I really question the validity of this framework, you are a questioner. Yes. So what we saw here was very consistent with what I see everywhere, which I think is just like the pattern of the world, which is that rebel is a very small tendency. It's a conspicuous tendency. It's a small group of people. What was much more surprising for me as I was writing the book was to realize that my tendency, upholder tendency, also very small. I mean, I remember going to my husband and being like, oh my gosh, it turns out like I'm on the freaky fringe. And he's like, you think? Yeah. Yeah. No one was surprised at me. These are the two small. They're the poles. They're the extremes. They're small. overwhelmingly people are questioners or obligers, and obliger is the biggest tendency. So let me make a few observations, particularly about questioners and obligers, because that's overwhelmingly who's in the room, and also if you're dealing with people, that's who you're going to deal with. Questioners, it can be very powerful to be a questioner or to be around questioners because they keep everybody on track. Why are we doing it this way? Why are we using this software? Why is it due by Friday? Why am I listening to you at all? You know, and it keeps everybody like focused and things efficient and rational. And then there's no wasted time on things that don't need to be done. However, questioners can often be draining to other people because their questions can be very tiresome. There you go. There you go. And they can sometimes be seen as like being like sassy if they're in school, like they're sassing the teacher, or being uncooperative or undermining to a boss who feels defensive or attacked by all the questions. And they often themselves can tire themselves out with questionings. They sometimes get analysis paralysis where they want more information, you know, in a world where it's not always possible to have perfect information or fast enough. And so if you're an obliger, you're an obliger, you want to help them get the benefit of that questioning tendency without becoming drained or overwhelmed or like alienate important relationships because the questioning is continuing. Next, obligers. If I had to say what is the thing that I hear the most from people is like, okay, this is the thing that totally changed my life. You know, this is the key insight that I took from your book that I feel like is unlocking my history, making sense of everything I've done before and allowing me to move forward. This is it. If you are an obliger or if you work closely with an obliger, and that is 100% of everybody because obliger is a huge tendency. If an obliger cannot meet an inner expectation, which by definition they can't, the answer, the solution, the critical missing piece, which is easily supplied, is outer accountability. If you give an obliger outer accountability for an inner expectation, they will meet it. And one of my favorite things about since the book comes out is getting all these ideas for obligers for the ingenious ways that they are giving themselves outer accountability for inner expectations. My very favorite was a woman who she lives by herself and she wanted to start getting up earlier. Interesting challenge. How do you do that? How do you give yourself outer accountability for getting up on earlier if you live by yourself? Like, who's going to do that? So she used the social media management platform Hootsuite to post an embarrassing Facebook post that goes up every morning at 8:15 a.m. unless she gets up to disable it. Right? Ingenious. Many obligers will talk about the fact that they teach a class in order to get themselves to do it. Like, I only exercise if I'm teaching an exercise class. It's a pretty extreme solution, but it seems to work for a lot of obligers. Anyway, there's a million different things that obligers can do. You know, the typical things are work with a partner, start a group. There's a starter kit on my site, GretchenRubin.com, for people who want to start accountability groups. You don't have to be doing the same thing. You just have to be holding each other accountable. Work with a coach. You know, exercise with somebody who'll be annoyed if you don't show up. Think of your duty as a role model to other people. There's a lot of solutions once you realize that's what's needed. But an important thing I would just say for obliger, two quick things about obligers because there's so many of them. First, obligers often fantasize that if outer expectations would diminish, inner expectations would then be fulfilled. If I quit my day job, then I will be able to pursue my dream of entrepreneurship. It does not work like that. There must be outer accountability. There must be outer accountability for those. Like a friend of mine was like, oh yeah, I told myself for years that I didn't exercise because of my kids, but like my kids have been out of the house for 10 months now and I still didn't exercise, right? Because that is not what really the issue is. What's needed is the outer accountability. Also, there's a very striking pattern with obligers. They will meet expectations and then suddenly they will snap and they are like, this I will not do. And it can be small and symbolic. Several, again, uncanny patterns. Several obligers tell me that they sit in their car deliberately to be late for work because they are so annoyed by an office mate who has needled them about being late in the past. So they're just like, you want me to be late? Watch me. And they will deliberately make themselves late on purpose. But this can also be a very destructive pattern, like a valuable employee walking out the door with no opportunity for the boss to make it right, blowing up a 20-year friendship because a friend has been too needy and demanding, and it's like, and the person has reached this point of explosion. So if you're an obliger, you're an obliger, you want to take steps to keep from reaching that place of extreme resentment and burnout. So anyway, I'm going to, and the last thing I would say about the tendencies is these aren't meant to be something that boxes you in and makes you feel like your possibilities are limited. It's meant to like, shine a spotlight on certain aspects of your personality or sort of certain patterns of behavior so that you can see like where you might tinker with things in order to get better results for yourself or for someone else. Because you can imagine if you're a doctor trying to get someone to take their blood pressure medication, if you're talking to an upholder or a questioner or an obliger or a rebel, you might want to have a very different message for them. Because the more you say to the rebel, you better follow the doctor's orders, the more the rebel's going to be like, you're not the boss of me. You can't make me. You know, so you want to be able to think about how to tailor tailor things to get the best out of yourself and the best out of other people. And I think it's worthwhile to think about our habits because, you know, habits are like the invisible architecture of everyday life. About 40% of our everyday existence is shaped by habits. And if we shape our habits, we can reshape our lives. So thank you very much. All right. So go to the mic for your question.
Two mics. One here, one here.
Yes.
You mentioned three unhealthy habits. I got the first and third. What's the middle?
Oh, of the unhealthy treats?
Yeah.
Food and drink, shopping, and screen time.
Shopping, thank you.
That's an easy question to answer. Yes.
When you said obliger, my first thought was that most of us women would be in that category. Does your research indicate the contrary? Or
yep. I don't think that there's a – it doesn't fall out along gender lines. I think sometimes women, many people are obligers. It's a large tendency. And I think that many women think that that women feel the way they do. And one of the things that was striking to me when I was doing the tendencies is because people would often say to me things like, why is it that busy moms like us can't take time for themselves? And I would think, well, I don't have any trouble taking time for myself. It wasn't the fact that she was a woman and I was a woman. It was that she was an obliger and I was an upholder. So, there are many, many men who are obligers. Andre Agassi. Who here has read the amazing memoir by Andre Agassi? Open. Go buy it right now. Because I'm not interested in tennis at all, but it's just an absolutely enthralling memoir. And he's 100% an obliger. And you can see how it's manifesting in this sort of hyper-masculine way. But absolutely obliger. So people ask that, and it seems like it would be true, but it doesn't seem to follow gender lines. Yes.
Hi. I think I'm a questioner, but I also, when you say, you know, you really need that pressure, that outer pressure, I can definitely identify with that. So I'm trying to figure this out a little bit. I'm wondering if it has, have you associated any of these types with Myers-Briggs or some other personality testing?
Right. No, you know, and people have people have emailed me about how it corresponds to the four yogic paths, the Enneagram. Somebody tried to match it up to Hogwarts. I'm like, that definitely does not work. And a friend of mine who's really an expert in Myers-Briggs, like, did kind of a match up for me. I feel like all of these frameworks have their own strength and their own nuance. And so I kind of hesitate to try to map them onto each other because then I think you sort of lose the texture. So I haven't really tried to do that. But one thing I would say about this, like Myers-Briggs tries to be sort of more of a total description of a person. The four tendencies is really a very, very narrow part of a person's personality. And like I'm an upholder, but like or a questioner or a rebel, like how ambitious you are, how creative you are, how considerate you are of other people's feelings, how smart you are, how curious you are, all these things will go into making people wildly different. And it's really just how they respond to an expectation. So I don't think that they map up that much. There's probably overlaps, but kind of they all have their own strengths. Yeah.
Do you ever see people switch from one to another?
You know, I think that with time and wisdom and experience, people learn to kind of offset the negatives of their tendency and go into the strengths. And so I think they can become sort of more and more happy, healthy, productive. Like even obligers who don't know they're obligers will sort of intuitively sense that they need accountability and will build that in so they almost will look like they're becoming a different tendency. But I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. And really the only people where I really truly believe that they have switched a tendency are the very few people. I mean, I know a very few people like this, probably you too, where truly they something happened to them. In the people I've seen, it was either a extremely life-threatening, near-death kind of experience or a long bout of addiction where you feel like they were somebody else before and now they're a different person. That's really rare. I think most of people, it's a hardwired tendency, it's pervasive, and people don't switch. And they're not one at work and one at home. It's like it's just part of your nature that you're born with. Yeah.
I'm a freshman in high school, and sometimes it's hard to have
good. You're talking to the mic so we get it recorded.
Sometimes it's hard to have good habits.
Yes, I have a junior, so I'm well aware.
Do you have any suggestions for teenagers?
I think the things that works for teenagers work for everybody. What's your tendency? Do you know? You don't know? Okay. There's a quiz on my site, by the way. If you go to, you can go to GretchenRubin.com, or the way to get directly to it is happiercast.com/quiz. And there's a quiz that you can take that will sort of spit out an answer. See, some things work well for everybody, but not for rebels. So, assuming that you're not a rebel, because there aren't that many rebels, and if you were a rebel, you wouldn't ask this question. You think she is a rebel? Oh, are you her mom?
Yeah.
Okay. Woo! Excellent. I love talking to rebels. Okay. So if you were a rebel, you really think she's a rebel?
I do.
All right. Okay.
Because I'm a rebel and she's
not. You are?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. It's good that you have a mom that's a rebel because then rebels will often say to me, I don't understand how other people could be the parents of rebels. It can be hard, I think, for a parent to manage if they don't have insight into this perspective. So here's the thing about rebels. And you tell me if you agree. Okay. Because this is the very hard for me to wrap my – took a lot of work for me to understand the rebel perspective because obviously it's exactly the opposite of upholder. For rebels, it's choice and freedom and identity. So you want to think about, what do I choose? What makes me the person that I want to be? And so because rebels can do anything that they want to do, but they won't do it because they're supposed to do it. And they won't do it because you tell them to do it. And so it's like, I want to do it. And they love choice. So it's like, I want to be able to choose to go to any school I want to go to. So what do I have to do that? Because I don't want a choice to be made for me. I don't want to feel trapped. But here's an interesting thing. Weird patterns. Many rebels will only apply to one school. And then they just sort of deal, like, they're like, I either get in or I don't get in. Then they feel like they're in control of that choice because it's like, I'm choosing, they're choosing. There's no, like, going through a process. And then identity. Like, if you think to yourself, well, I'm a responsible person. I'm a curious person. I have a lot to say. Therefore, it sounds interesting to me to meet this challenge. So tying it to a sense of identity is very strong. But also, if your mom's a rebel, maybe then you're not like constantly hounding her and reminding her and stuff, because that's so counterproductive with rebels. The more you tell them what to do, then the more they have to resist in order to show that they're acting from choice and freedom. And the more you're like, you can drop out of high school if you want. Like, I don't know how that's going to work out for you, but it's an option. Then they don't feel like they have to do it to show that they can. Is this ringing true?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I do sometimes because I think I'm supposed to.
Yeah.
Do the,
it doesn't work though, does it?
It doesn't work, right?
Well, what one rebel said was that it's very important for rebels to be able to experience the consequences of their action because they will do what they want to do. Like one rebel was like, I now pay my bills. I mean, pay my taxes because I know what happens when I don't, you know? Or another rebel friend of mine wouldn't wear a seatbelt until he got several really like high fines, and now he wears a seatbelt. And so what one parent said is you can't protect rebel children from consequences because the more you do, then the more they're like, well, this works for me because I'm getting like there's no problem with doing it. This can be very scary as a parent to allow somebody to experience the consequences of their actions. When you really start thinking about it, you realize how much parents really try to protect children from the consequences of their actions. But with a rebel, it's like that's it. So. Yeah, good luck, good luck. Do you want to come to the mic so we can hear your question? Can you get over there? They need to capture it for the recording, so you have to be in the mic for that reason. What happened?
How do you think we develop these tendencies, and like how much is nurture and how much is nature?
I think it's hardwired. I think we come into the... I think that they're part of our just in nature. And people will point to things, but I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I think I'm an obliger because I was a middle child. I'm like, well, yeah, but you could think you're an obliger because you're a first child or a third child or a fourth child or, you know what I mean? I think this is genetically determined. Yeah. And it's very consistent. The distribution is very consistent too. So, yeah. Yeah.
Have to go
crank it down.
Okay, yeah. All right. You've addressed the fact that people don't usually switch or don't ever switch tendencies. I took your quiz on the website, and I am an upholder.
You are? Okay. You, the few, the proud, quiz. Yeah.
Yeah. But in the last fall, I had like a very chaotic, like I was doing my student teaching internship, and it was just a lot. And I found myself behaving a lot like an obliger. Like I couldn't meet all my own expectations. So I would put, you know, deadlines and that kind of stuff in front. And so my question is it possible for people to switch for a very short period of time? Or did I cheat on your quiz to try to be like a unicorn upholder?
Oh. When you say you were you saying that you were meeting outer expectations because you couldn't meet both outer and inner expectations?
Yes, because of just the
sheer volume,
the demands of that internship in that short amount of time.
So, okay, you asked, so now we're going to get into slight more complexity. And I'm writing a book about this where it's all like laid out. But so all the tendencies overlap with other tendencies. So this is like being Scorpio with Leo rising or whatever. Or the Enneagram, you know, how you're weighted. So what you might be is some upholders are more like questioners, where there's more weight to the inner. And some upholders are more like obligers, where there's slightly more weight to the outer. Now, you're still an upholder because you still have this strong outer and inner, but you kind of tip one way or the other. There's kind of a leaning. So if maybe when there's a conflict between outer and inner, for you, the outer is the one that would win. But then the minute that you can get back to your inner, then the inner becomes into balance. Now, that is different from an obliger, because an obliger, no matter what the system is, the outer is going to feel very, very pressing, and the inner will feel like it does not have weight. So I think you might be just kind of tipped. You might be an upholder who's tipped to obliger.
Okay, that makes so much sense. Thank you.
And that's true of all the tendencies. Like, they can kind of manifest in slightly different ways.
I'll ask my question without giving you the backstory first. But if you really need to know it, I can tell it.
Okay.
I'm interested in how would you go about changing someone's or changing your own patterns of thought?
Oh, that's interesting because, see, in the book, I don't address nervous habits or habits of mind. Because habits of mind being things like pessimism, that kind of thing?
Self-efficacy. See, the backstory is this. Everyone in my family says me and my sister have very similar personalities. And when we recount the family history, my version of events has people doing things, and her version of events has things happening to her. And
right.
I just shake my head. I don't know how anyone can live that way with no self-efficacy at all.
It's just, I
don't know how would you get yourself out of bed in the morning if you lived that way?
Yeah.
So that's
kind of
sound
like an upholder. What's your tendency?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
I haven't read the book. But
I
suspect it's radically different from my sister's.
Yeah. You know, I don't tackle habits of mind because I think it's much easier to work on concrete, like habits that are actions that we take.
I wish people had only problems like that.
Yay.
It would be much simpler
than
habits of mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Next book. You need to go to the mic. So, sorry, it's just for the recording.
Of the four tendencies, is there any linkage with happiness, or is it just if you're high functioning in a tendency, you're happier?
That is an interesting question. So what I've found is that there's not, and you are exactly right in what you propose, which is it's really, when you look at the people the happiest, healthiest, and the most productive, they're the people who have sort of figured out themselves, and they've set up things so that everything works for them. So there are many obligers where everything in their life that they want to do for themselves, there's some form of outer accountability. So they're not even aware of any kind of frustration, you know, because everything is happening just as they would want it to. You know, for years, my mother, who's an obliger, would walk with a friend who lived next door. I mean, there was no sense of like that. So there was no frustration because everything was being met. That desire to exercise was being met. And all four can if they don't figure it out, they can't, you know, if you've got a questioner in a job where all the questioning buttons are being pushed every day, they're going to feel miserable, you know, whereas if they were in a different kind of environment, they might feel great. So I think it's not that there's any one tendency, but it has to do with how people kind of get themselves in the situation that's going to support them and also offset the limitations, because there definitely are, all these have limitations. So you have to, if you figure that out, then you don't experience the downside as much.
Yeah. So I took your test. I'm an obliger.
Okay.
However, I think there are some areas of my life where I'm better than others.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, when I'm trying to lose weight, I'm losing weight with somebody, I'm currently dieting with somebody, or yeah, I'm studying with somebody, so far and so forth. However, in the relationship example that you gave, when, you know, somebody is needy and sort of you deal as an obliger with that somebody.
Yeah.
That's very tricky. That's like human relationships, and I'm really curious in your perspective on that, because it's not like I can talk to somebody else about my relationship with that somebody. I don't know how to make myself accountable outside necessarily to respond to my inner need of not giving so much time to that person that it's so needy. So I'm just wondering.
So you're saying that you sort of like everything that they, I need your time, I need to talk to you for 2 hours on the
exactly.
phone. I need you to meet me for coffee.
Yeah.
You need to go with me to this appointment.
Yeah.
Needy, needy, needy.
Yeah.
So one of the ways that you can, this is the thing that can work really well for obligers, is you find somebody who's on your side. Whether it could be like, if it's an office thing, maybe it's a coworker, or maybe it's a spouse or a best friend or a sibling or a parent or somebody who you trust. And you could just say, and just insert a moment where you're like, okay, so your friend says, I need you to go with me to this appointment. You could say, okay, I need to check my calendar. Let me get back to you. And then call your sister and say, she says I have to go to the appointment with her. Do I have to go? And then your sister will be like, that's crazy. You don't have to go. She's taking up too much of your time. You tell her no, you know? And you better call me and tell me you told her no. And then you're like, then there's somebody who's saying, what's going on? So like somebody was saying to me that he traveled too much for work. So what he did was he said that his assistant every month had to send him, his wife, and the assistant a total number of nights away from home. And so it was just like knowing that somebody was going to be looking at that number helped him to say no when his team was like, can you be the one to go to Milwaukee? He's like, actually, no, because I had 8 times last month or whatever it is. So if you can think of a person to put in there who will watch your back. Now, in a work situation, a lot of times it needs to be like a boss or a supervisor where somebody's like, look, you've been dragged into 5 teams here. That's not possible. I know a guy who had a really, really valuable obliger, because obligers are often great employees, right? And great bosses, too. And they said, and he said at her review, he said, you're doing too much work too well. And I mean that as a sincere criticism, because it wasn't sustainable. So they had to step in as an organization and say, everybody's dragging you onto their team because you do a great job and you're not saying no. So we're going to step in and say that you're being taken advantage of and it's not sustainable. So we're going to say no. So if you can think of a way to insert somebody in there, that might be a way.
Okay, we're beginning to run out of time. How many people have we got at the mic over here? Three? Okay, we've got time for 3 more.
Okay.
These 3 quick questions.
Okay.
Hi, so I was surprised when you asked about morning people and night people that it was about half and half. I didn't think there'd be that many night people, and I'm a night person.
The world is set up for morning people, right? It's not fair.
I read that either in your book or heard it on your podcast, that jobs in school tend to be more for morning people.
Yeah.
And other than getting a new job or a new husband,
yeah.
which wouldn't make me happier because I love them both, what strategies do you have for night people to adapt to kind of morning society, morning jobs, morning schools, things like that?
Well, I think part of it is like accepting the fact that you are a night person and trying to set up your circumstances, because I think a lot of night people are constantly trying to work on themselves. And so to say like, well, and it's not always possible with every job or whatever, to say like, would it be possible for me not to come in until 10? Or could we move the staff meeting from 9 until 10 because I'm going to be like much more alert and be much more contributing a lot more? Sometimes it's not possible, but sometimes it is possible if you just are really upfront about it. One thing that I know when couples were once a morning person and once a night person, like sometimes there's sort of this whole battle, like you both have to be up and helping with the kids and why are you, you know, you're not getting out of bed. And then when you do, you're so cranky and you're not even helpful. Well, it's good to have a night person, too. So maybe the morning person does the morning because that's their strong point, and then the night person does the night because that's their strong point, instead of thinking like everybody's got to help or because the thing is night people just are not at their best then. And so and my whole thing with habits or and happiness and everything generally is instead of feeling like there's something wrong with you, say, how can I get the world to suit me better? Because there's often a lot more flexibility when we're clear about what we need than we think. But so often we blame ourselves and think like, well, you know, why is it that I can't, you know, everybody else is getting up at, you know, 7 a.m. Why can't I get up at 7 a.m.? If you can't get up at 7 a.m. and be your best, like maybe you can. So I would, you know, just talk to them and see if there's something you can do. Some things like getting kids off to school, there's not that much flexibility unless you can get your husband to take over. But good luck.
Thanks so much for talking to us. It strikes me that the happiness, that the gap in happiness might be between our own expectations of ourselves wanting to be one type. Like, I wish I were an upholder, but I'm not.
Right.
I have expectations of myself, what I want to achieve in the world. I want to achieve what upholders are able to achieve, but I'm a total questioner.
Uh-huh.
And that's all. I can't help it. So how do you sort of fix that, the gap between your expectations for yourself and what you're actually able to do because your personality causes that questioner's paralysis? That you referred to of analyzing.
Yeah.
What did you call it?
Analysis paralysis. Do you
totally
feel that?
True. Oh, every day.
Yeah.
Like, even with the smallest decisions.
No. A friend of mine's a questioner, married to a questioner, and she said their dishwasher was broken for 2 years because it was like, what kind of dishwasher? Do we need to replace the countertops? Maybe we need to do the roof deck, you know? And it was like, but here's the thing. I think instead of framing it as like, I wish I were this, I feel frustrated because I'm not that. So, how can I change? It's more like these are the aims that I want to meet. How can I set things up so using my tendency to get me there? Because the questioner are very powerful. They're totally interdirected. Like many upholders wish they were questioners because there's a lot of value to being a questioner. And so just to harness the questioner tendency to get you to your aims, because it doesn't really matter what your tendency is as long as you have the life that you want. And so I think sometimes when people get caught up in wishing that they were in a different tendency, it's more like, no, just work with what you get, what you get, and you don't get upset, and just like, you know, figure out how to set up a situation so that it's not triggering your questioner problems or it's answering the questions that you need to have answered in order to be able to follow through. Because a lot of times when questioners are like, oh, you know, I can't stick to this diet, I'm like, yeah, but do you think this is the best, most efficient way to eat? And they're like, no, I think this nutritionist is like full of it. I'm like, well, then of course you're not going to stick to it. You know what I mean? Because you're a questioner. You're not going to do something just because somebody told you to. And so to like kind of go deep into your tendency.
And our dishwasher handle has been broken for 2 years.
Oh, there you go.
That's true. That's a true story because we can't decide what model to get.
Yes, there you go. There you go. There you go. There you go.
That's
okay,
true.
Okay, so here's your striking patterns, right? Okay, so here's the thing. Set a deadline. By February 15th, we're going to have picked a dishwasher. That's it.
But
February
15th. Will say, but why? We haven't decided yet.
I asked a group one time. They were divided into their tendencies, and I was like, come up with a motto for your tendency. And then I asked this on the podcast too. I got the most amazing answers, people, what their mottos were for their tendencies. But my favorite was we went around the room to ask what the motto was, and the questioner motto was, why do we have to have a motto? Yeah. So if you say like, but just say like, because we want to have a dishwasher. So, well, good luck. Okay. Last question. You get a gold star for asking the last question.
I bought a dishwasher yesterday.
Mm. There you go. It can be done.
And
it's possible.
It took me a long time because I am an obliger, and I wanted to make sure it was a dishwasher that my husband liked, even though I do the dishes.
Right. Interesting.
So my
that's an interesting wrinkle.
This is more just a thought as opposed to a question. So I'm an obliger, and last year for my New Year's resolution, it was be kind to your future self.
Mm-hmm.
So I treated myself like another person.
Yes,
like a guest in my house.
Yes,
almost.
And yes,
I was able to change a lot of habits.
Like what? Yes, this is something that a lot of obligers have talked about. Is like this kind of disassociation almost from self. Yeah. Okay.
Like, I make my bed in the morning because it's nice to come home and when I'm ready to go to bed, the bed is made for me. Or I make the coffee the night before so that when I wake up, it's there for me. I don't drink the extra glass of wine because
yes.
in the morning,
right.
that Kathleen will not feel as good
yes.
as
yes.
she thought
yes.
she was
yes.
going to. that type of stuff.
So one of the things that's interesting about obligers is what triggers a feeling of accountability. There's huge variation. And you're very fortunate because you're able to create kind of an imaginary external accountability with yourself. It still feels like it's an outer, but it's actually intergenerated. That's really great because there's so much power to that. Another way that a lot of obligers do it is they'll fantasize that like they're playing a role. I'm a house cleaner here. Like, I don't live here. You know, I'm just like, they're paying me to come vacuum, like, whatever. I got to do my job. I have got an hour and a half, you know, and then they do it. So these kind of things. Some obligers, I will say, are not able to do that, to generate their own feelings of outer accountability. They really need actual consequences from a real life person. And so it's much harder for them to create that outer accountability. Here's another way that there's variation. Paying. For some obligers, if they pay for something, they feel obligated to go. For some obligers, it almost feels like they're off the hook. They're like, well, I paid. Like, that's practically the same thing as going. If you are an obliger and you're trying to create that outer accountability, be thinking about what's actually going to work for you, because even among obligers, like your strategy, which is such a flexible, powerful strategy, unfortunately, some obligers wouldn't be able to use it. But some can, and that's great. That's a brilliant. And you came up with it. You intuitively knew that you had to set it up that way in order to stick through it. So it's a great, great example of just if you know yourself and what works for you, then you can set up your life so that you get where you want, no matter what kind of person you are. So thank you very much, everyone.
You were wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.